Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the BFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Erika Engelhaupt, the author of Gory Details, Adventures from the Dark Side of Science. Would your dog eat you if you died? What are face mites? Why do clowns creep us out? In this illuminating collection of grisly true science stories, journalist Erika Engelhaupt, the writer of the National Geographic's highly acclaimed Gory Details blog, shares the answers to these questions and many more. Gory Details, Adventures from the Dark Side of Science, explores the strange and shocking realities of our minds, our bodies, and our universe, taking readers on a fascinating tour through overlooked but astonishing aspects of biology, anatomy, nature, and more, as well as the ways that science helps to break down taboos surrounding such conversation topics as women's bodies. Blending humor and real science, Engelhaupt shares captivating stories and intriguing research that will alter the way readers view the world. From a peek inside the world's smallest crime scenes to a hands-on look at maggot farming, Gory Details features top-notch reporting, interviews with leading scientists, and a healthy dose of wit. Okay, so it's my pleasure to welcome Erika here today.
Thanks for having me.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for coming. So I would like to start by asking, how has the pandemic influenced you and your work?
Yes. Well, it's definitely affected my work like most people. I was actually in London doing reporting for a story that I was working on for National Geographic when the travel was shut down between Europe and the US. So that was a really kind of crazy, surreal experience being there when all of a sudden the pandemic went from something that we were kind of keeping an eye on to suddenly a very, very big deal. And I was, you know, very nervous about whether I would be able to get home from the UK. Of course, everything worked out. I was able to get home and didn't get COVID. So I was very fortunate. It did throw off the story that I was working on, which has had to be delayed because we can't finish the reporting and photography for it. And it pushed back the publication of my book, Gory Details, by almost a year. So those were the things that were the hardest for me, were just professionally having everything be put on hold. And so, but overall, I've been very lucky. I was already a freelancer, so I was used to working from home. And my parents just got their vaccine shots, so I'm very happy about that and feeling very relieved that maybe in the US here we are going to start coming down on cases and that things might be looking up.
Excellent. So apart from that stranded experience right in the beginning, do Did you feel a lot of change within your general sort of work routine and plans for the projects?
Yeah, what I ended up doing was basically having to, you know, switch everything around in my professional life around COVID, because we, as science writers, all of a sudden, this is the story of the century. And so everything else pretty much got put on hold. And I've been focusing on working for Science News Magazine, where I had worked previously, doing a lot of editing work for them. And so I've been involved in a lot of the coverage of COVID-19 and editing a lot of stories about that, as well as about all kinds of other areas of science. But that has helped. It feels good as a science writer to be able to contribute in some way to, you know, stories about the pandemic and better, you know, public education on science and spreading the word about the science of the virus.
Yes, for sure. And we're really lucky to have you as a first line media responder who can write good stories, so not hyped stories about this subject, to educate people.
Yeah, and I think that science writers have done a really good job overall. I think it's been very, very challenging. So many reporters I know are just exhausted and burnt out, and it's very hard fighting all of the misinformation now about vaccination and the vaccines. It's, you know, it's definitely an uphill battle trying to make sure that people get the right information, because there's just a constant flood of misinformation.
Mm. So how do you catch your breath? It must be really tiring.
It is. But, you know, I'm very lucky. I live in beautiful Knoxville, Tennessee. And so I'm surrounded by lakes and rivers and mountains and the outdoors. And so when I need a break from it all, I can go outside, go for a long walk, go for a hike. That was actually one of the hard things for me in the beginning of the pandemic was I remember going out with my husband and wanting to go for a little hike. And the trails and paths were all just full of people not wearing masks. This was very early in the pandemic. And I got so frustrated. I remember crying because I thought, you know, I can't go anywhere, but I want to go outside. And it was very frustrating that, you know, people were making it so that it didn't even feel safe to be outside walking on a trail. And we're doing a lot better now, I think. People in my area are wearing masks now, and I do feel much safer going for a hike these days. But that's been really one of my big releases, is to be able to get outside.
Oh, yeah, I understand fully. I always go to for hikes in Alps in Switzerland. But we've also experienced something that you describe. But also we could see that many more people started coming out. So once something is being prohibited, people tend to do this, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think I had ever seen so many people out on the trails as I did early in the pandemic. And I think people felt very cooped up. They felt they didn't want to be in the house. There was, you know, everything else was closed. So there was a lot of demand to get outdoors. And I appreciated that very much. I was glad for people to get outdoors. But I wanted them to do so safely. And I think that people now are doing a lot better on that. And I hope people will continue to turn to the outdoors to get them in a, you know, good state of mind. And as we continue to, you know, move on through the pandemic.
Yeah, that's a great advice. Get outdoors.
Absolutely.
Okay, so can you tell me a bit more about yourself? So your background?
Sure. So I grew up loving science and nature and animals, the outdoors. I had a little bit of an unusual childhood in the sense that my dad is an engineer and he was always bringing science home. So he even built his own laboratory on our property when I was a kid. And so I remember having this building that my father built outside of our home that was just full of, you know, lab equipment. And I, of course, didn't even understand what most of it was for. But I remember him, you know, being in there with me and showing me how to electroplate one metal onto a different metal, things like that. And so I grew up really in a good position. I guess it's not surprising, in a sense, that I ended up going to college and studying biology and being attracted to science. And I've really never given up that kind of curiosity that I had as a little kid. One story that I tell in the introduction of my book is about growing up. I was in Kansas City, Missouri, as a small child. And we had this funny thing that happened where a dentist's office closed down near our house, and they came and they dumped everything from their office at the end of our driveway. It was really strange. Just we get home and we lived out in the country, and all of a sudden there was just this pile of everything from this dentist's office on our property. And I remember going through and looking at all of the x-rays of people's teeth and picking out all of the plaster molds of people's teeth. And I really liked all the ones that were really crooked. And I was just really fascinated by that. And I think that I've kind of kept that sense of curiosity, you know, ever since. I had no problem with it being kind of like weird or gross. And I think that that tells you something about maybe the kind of kid I was. I had that curiosity. I think most kids do. And I think, you know, hopefully we never grow out of that sense of curiosity and wonder. So I'd like to think that I have kept that sense of curiosity ever since then. I grew up moving around quite a bit because of my father's jobs in engineering. And so I've lived in various parts of the United States, mostly in the South. And so I've had a really fun and interesting upbringing, seeing different parts of the country. And I think that influenced me as well. So, and then I went to college. Like I said, I studied biology and ended up falling in love with science writing while I was in graduate school. So I studied biology and environmental science, and I have master's degrees in both of those fields, and then became a science writer. And it was, you know, terrifying to kind of switch fields, but I found that I really loved writing about science. I loved learning something new every day. I loved feeding that curiosity and learning about all different areas of science rather than focusing in on one more narrow field. And as you know, you're a graduate student yourself, right? So I know you're familiar with this. You know, as when you become a scientist, you have to really focus on very particular areas and even particular questions that you're asking, and those will often follow you throughout your career. And that's wonderful. And I love scientists who are able to have that focus. But for me, I have found that I really love the breadth of writing about all kinds of science. And I really like, I really have a hard time focusing on one question for my, for my entire career. I have so many questions that I want to follow. So science writing has really allowed me to do that.
So you masterfully really share and engage your audience. So do you think you always had that knack for it, or did you learn?
I think that I was, you know, I was always very interested in writing and telling stories. And I think I had a creative side for explaining things. I always liked writing. In fact, even in graduate school, I actually enjoyed writing my scientific papers as much as doing the lab work. But it's definitely a skill that you have to learn. I had a lot of enthusiasm going in. And what I think a lot of people in science have a hard time appreciating is how difficult it is to really switch gears and explain things to the public, not just in a way that is clear and accurate, but also in a way that people want to read it, that it's interesting, that it's entertaining, and that you're really telling a story. You have to put people into the story. It can't just be about science, or, you know, sometimes people won't really relate to it if you're just telling them facts like it's out of a textbook. They really want to read stories about the people behind the science as well. So learning to do all of that was really a challenge, of course. I got my start by pretty much jumping in and starting to pitch stories to the local newspaper while I was in graduate school in Boulder, Colorado. And I just pitched ideas until finally they took one. And then they gave me an internship there. And learning how to write at a daily newspaper, I think, was really crucial for me. I think it's a really fantastic experience. I wish more scientists actually could have that experience of having to quickly learn about something new in science and write an interesting, compelling story for the general public to read about it. Because I would maybe get an assignment at 9 o'clock in the morning of something to write about, and I would have to turn in my first draft of the story after lunch. So it was, you know, very quick process of maybe reading a scientific paper, finding someone to interview, calling scientists, and basically seeing who I could get on the phone quickly to talk to about this scientific discovery, and then sitting down and trying to write something coherent in, you know, an hour or so. So I really enjoyed the rush of doing that. I ended up writing for the Boulder, Colorado newspaper, the Daily Camera, and then I had a fellowship writing for the Philadelphia newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer. And I really liked that daily rush of getting a story done. And I learned so much doing that. You know, you have to learn really fast. So I really enjoyed that. I think it was really just the best learning experience that you could have.
So what would be your advice to our early career scientists who perhaps are considering careers in science communication, but are not really sure where and how to start?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot. I find that a lot of scientists, early career scientists especially, are really interested in communicating with the public. They often aren't sure what to do with it. Do I need to go to journalism school? Do I need to get an English degree? I mean, I didn't know these things getting started either. Today, there are actually a number of science writing programs that you can go to at universities. And those are one way to get a good start, and at least to find information about you know, what the options are in a career in science communication. Because there are many, there's journalism and science writing like what I do, but then there's also a wide variety of other career paths. There are a lot of really talented writers and communicators who work for universities as public information officers and who work for big laboratories. There's just a lot of different things that you can do to get involved. And even if you want your main career to be as a scientist, there are still ways that you can improve your communication to the public and get involved in other kinds of writing for the public, whether it's writing books, writing a column for your local newspaper, whatever it is. There are a lot of ways that you can write for the public as a scientist as well.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent advice. Absolutely. Okay, so let's jump to discussion about your book, which is The Gory Details. So Great. Am I correct thinking that you also had a blog on National Geographic under the same name?
Correct, yes. And I started the blog actually back when I worked at Science News Magazine and called it Gory Details. And then when I went to go work for National Geographic, I took the blog with me and did it there for a while as well. And I really, it was, you know, just such a great opportunity for me to start exploring some of the subjects that I was interested in. There's really was no better way than a blog where it's almost like that sense I had when I worked for daily newspapers, where you can find out about something and then write about it, you know, pretty quickly and get it out there and get a lot of feedback from readers as well. So I really enjoyed blogging. And over time, I ended up amassing, you know, all of these stories that I had written. And so it was really wonderful when I started talking to National Geographic about the idea of turning this into a book. So I already had a lot of material, but of course we wanted to have a lot of new stuff too. So once we decided that we would turn it into a book, I did a lot more reporting and got to do some travel and come up with a bunch of new stories to add in as well, as expanding and adding to and updating the stories that I had written before.
Yeah, and your blog also has some really vital references, something that's it's absolutely, you know, necessary to know, like human nutritional profile or whether your dog would eat you if you died.
That's right.
Yeah, that's definitely something which is really important for everybody to know.
Okay. Well, it's certainly something that people are more curious about than I would have thought. When I that particular story, would your dog eat you if you died? That was one that in particular I was nervous about writing for National Geographic. I thought maybe this is just going too far. Maybe this is just too gross. Does anyone else really wonder about this? But, you know, a friend of mine had asked me about it. She lives by herself and has pets. And she said, you know, I heard that this can happen, that, you know, someone's dog or cat might eat them when after they die, if they're, you know, if their body is in the house. And is that something, you know, that I should really worry about? And I could tell she was actually, you know, kind of freaked out by this idea. And when I started looking into it, I realized actually a lot of people had this question because there are these stories of it happening. And so even though I was nervous about writing about it, that story is probably the most read story I've ever written. I was really surprised at how popular it was. I mean, I think, you know, more than 1 million people have read that story based on, you know, the numbers that I saw some time back. And so that really surprised me. It told me that, yes, actually people are interested, even when it's something as absolutely horrifying as the idea of your dog eating you.
Oh, yes. After this story, I'm living in existential dread of my guinea pigs chomping on my big toe.
Well, you know, you're not safe with guinea pigs, as I talk about in the story. So you know, it could happen. But, you know, the best thing you can do is make sure that, you know, there's someone to find you should the need arise.
Excellent practical advice.
Yeah.
So why are people so interested in these sorts of taboo topics?
You know, I think that when it comes to these kinds of gross or creepy or scary topics, I think that we actually are all interested in these kinds of things. We're often just too embarrassed to talk about them. I think we all know that kids like gross stuff and we're fine with that. But then we act like we're supposed to lose interest in anything gross or creepy or weird when we grow up. But I don't think that we ever actually lose that curiosity. So I'm just trying to give people permission to think about it and even to laugh about it. You know, all of these topics like sex, death, our bodies, our mental health, these are actually really important things that we need to talk about. So I hope that I can make it a little bit easier to talk about them, even though they're uncomfortable, by showing with science how amazing and actually interesting these topics are. And sometimes they're even pretty funny.
Mm. So why do you think some of the science topics can be taboo and other topics are not? Is there any specific criteria to it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of it comes back to our sense of disgust. I think there's, you know, one of the things that I hope people walk away from this book with is, you know, this greater sense that a lot of these things are tied together. Disgust, taboos, stigma. You know, we've become very uptight in some ways about these topics, especially when it relates to our body and things that we think are gross or disgusting. They become taboo. I think that a lot of it does come back to our sense of disgust. You know, for example, the types of things that are often considered taboo. You've got things like, you know, death and killing, sex and reproduction, anything having to do with the dead, and often a lot of taboos around food. For example, you've also got cannibalism that is a taboo that kind of combines death and food. So, and then our bodies, cleanliness, purity, you know, a lot of taboos around our bodies. A lot of these overlap a lot with the same things that we find disgusting. So disgust is this universal human emotion where we feel repulsed by certain things. Often those are things that can hurt us, that can make us sick. So disgust tends to revolve around, you know, many of those same kinds of things: death, illness, disease, our bodies, our bodily fluids, which could carry disease. So I think there's a good reason in many cases why we're disgusted by certain things, why we end up making things taboo that have to do with those subjects. You know, you don't want to encourage people to touch a dead body because a dead body is covered with bacteria that could make you sick. You know, something that's decomposing could make you sick. So it makes good sense in many cases for us to have, you know, developed these negative feelings about certain topics like death and sex and so forth, our bodies. But then we sometimes maybe have taken it to the next level. We start to make it more of a moral issue. When it's taboo, there's kind of this moral element to it that you shouldn't do that. It's bad. And once we start calling these things bad, then you've got the opportunity to sometimes, you know, elaborate on that and take it to the point where we are now. So for example, it makes good sense to avoid other people's waste products, body fluids, things like that, because they might carry disease. But then we, you know, in Western society have also made even the process, the menstrual cycle and menstruation has a lot of taboo and a lot of stigma around it. But it's just a natural part of our lives, of women's lives, of our, you know, reproductive lives. It's really not something that we should be ashamed or embarrassed about, but because we carry a lot of baggage with all of this disgust and taboos around things, we end up making some things taboo or thinking that they're disgusting. And that may actually be hurting us in some ways. You know, maybe some things don't need to be so stigmatized. And I think that some of the things that I talk about in the book, like, you know, menstruation is a good example of it. And also mental health, where we've developed so much stigma around it that it really stops people from being able to be as healthy as they could be.
Yeah, so you perfectly outlined this peculiar emotion of disgust. So we have two basic understanding of it, don't we? The intuitive one, which relates directly to things that can harm us, like bugs, and then the moral disgust, which is culturally mediated. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. We, you know, as humans, I think all animals have some sense of avoidance or some sense of disgust, basically. You know, animals will avoid their own feces or the feces of others, for example. So we all have that inherent protective mechanism, but humans have taken it to another level. Like you say, we've added, you know, this cultural element on top of it of, you know, we've added this cultural element on top of it where we add a moral element. And that's something that, you know, as far as I know, other animals don't have. That's unique to humans, where we make it, you know, we add this cultural element. And in one sense, it's good. I mean, this is how humans developed the concept of manners. It keeps us from being disgusted by one another because we do things like cover our mouths when we sneeze, and we, you know, try not to do disgusting things in front of one another. And, you know, I think that makes the world certainly a more tolerable place for all of us. I can't even imagine if we didn't have a sense of disgust and if we hadn't developed a sense of manners in order to keep us from being grossed out by each other all the time, we would be so rude. But even though in that sense, disgust is a good thing and has kind of made us who we are as humans in a sense, or at least certainly helped to shape our society, there also can be a downside to it, I think, where we make ourselves actually more ashamed and embarrassed of things than we need to be.
Choose some of the topics of disgust change over time within cultures. Like you made an example of mental health, but it can also take the bodily deformities, for example, and stuff like this. And do we need to actively work to change our disgust preferences, if that makes any sense, or is it naturally evolving?
I think we do need to work on it a bit. You know, I think it happens over time. You see a lot of evolution, I think, in our thinking about things like mental health and our bodies and our, you know, embarrassing bodily functions and things like that. I think we are starting to get over it somewhat. But I think in Western society, you know, Europeans, Americans, we're very prudish in a lot of ways still. And I think that it is something that we need to work a bit to be more open-minded about. So I hope that with writing about these kinds of things, that I'm helping people start that conversation. But things, for example, even eating insects, okay, that was something that for me was very difficult to do. But I tried it. I went to a whole conference, a scientific conference on eating insects. And there are a lot of good reasons why people probably should be eating more insects around the world. They're not only, you know, healthy and a good protein source, but they're much better for the environment in terms of the impact of agriculture. And so there are plenty of good reasons to do it. The one big reason that we don't eat more insects is really boils down to disgust. And it is completely, in that case, cultural. There are insects that are eaten around the world by lots of people who don't find it disgusting at all. And probably most of us have ancestors in our past who ate different kinds of insects, you know, different grasshoppers and crickets and things like that have been eaten widely in the Americas. And, you know, there are lots of examples, even in European cuisine, of foods that involve different kinds of insects. So it's really something that, unless we actually try to get over it, we, you know, we're really going to just always be missing out on that potential source of protein and feeding people who, you know, basically feeding people who need food, who need healthy food, and reducing our environmental impact. So when I went to the Eating Insects Conference, I committed that I was going to try everything that they put in front of us. And they did have a big buffet dinner with lots of different insect dishes. And I tried a number of things. And, you know, most of it was actually pretty good. But it was hard for me personally, I will admit, just growing up as an American woman, I never experienced eating any kind of insect. And so that first time of putting a cricket in my mouth, it wasn't that easy. I'll admit that. but most of it really didn't. I just kept telling myself, lots of people eat these things. Once you kind of get over the fact that it has the wrong number of legs, it really, logically, that it's not that different from eating any other kind of meat. It's not really that different from eating a shrimp, for example. Why is a shrimp not disgusting, but a big cricket is disgusting? That's something that is really a product of our culture and how we grow up and what we're accustomed to.
So do you think you would be more accepting of, for example, insect flour that's been integrated in breads and such?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I personally have no problem at this point with, eating something like that, especially if it's unrecognizable. I mean, I admit it's harder when you actually see a whole insect and you're not used to eating that. It's like eating any other kind of novel food. It can be a bit of a challenge, but especially if it's, in a protein shake or something like that, I would have no problem with that. And I think more people, if they did just give it a try, maybe start small, start with something like a protein smoothie that has some cricket powder in it, where you won't even know the difference. You won't taste it. That's a good way of just getting yourself mentally past that barrier of it's an insect, and then maybe work your way up to something, a little fried grasshopper or something like that. They're really not that bad. actually, I thought one of the easier entry points at the conference was they had a lot of people were making little dried seasoned mealworms. And yeah, it did have that kind of, a skinny shape. You could tell that it was a mealworm. But by the time you put a bunch of chili pepper and, lemon or garlic or something on it, it just tastes like whatever is on it. And it's crunchy. And it's not that different from eating any other kind of, chips or crisps or whatever. So starting off with something like that, I think makes it a lot easier. And I think it's nice to feel, there's a good feeling that comes when you've faced a challenge like that and you've gotten over it and you've said, oh, I thought that would be really disgusting, but actually it wasn't that bad. I don't know. I kind of felt proud of myself for getting through it. I think a lot of people would probably feel that way if they gave it a try.
Yeah, it's really good points of starting, taking small steps to change your behavior, perhaps, then maybe use some seasonings, some chili peppers, mm-hmm. and then integrate it into your daily life to have it more like a routine rather than something extraordinary that you have to pull yourself together to do, isn't it?
That's right. And I think, it's a nice way if you, oh no, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Sorry. I accidentally hit something on my computer. We'll start that over. yes, I think that it's a great idea to start off with something small, and especially if you're interested in being more environmentally friendly, then, incorporating something like, cricket powder or that kind of flour into your cooking is a nice way to get started.
Excellent. Okay, so can you tell me what disgust has to do with politics? So I'm not really sure how to reconcile these two, but...
Well, I would just say that I think that we should be aware of our sense of disgust and how sometimes other people try to manipulate it. And so I think it does have something to do with politics in the sense that throughout history, we have seen politicians and leaders use disgust against groups of people that they want to attack or disenfranchise. So, for example, even Fidel Castro, the communist leader in Cuba, he would call his opponents worms, gusanos, and, you know, he would invoke these kinds of ideas that they're disgusting, they're worms. And we've seen other political leaders do things like that. So to vilify other people, we make them disgusting. We say they're, you know, we compare them to animals, or say that they're going to bring disease into our country in the case of immigrants. And there's been a lot of that, you know, I think in the United States in particular, we're really grappling with issues around immigration and other people from other parts of the world coming to our country. And sometimes they do get vilified in ways that use our disgust against them, trying to make them seem less than human and or dirty, filthy, threatening in those ways that trigger our disgust. So I think it's just something that people could be more aware of and be on the lookout when a politician is describing other people in words that trigger that feeling of disgust. You know, we need to be aware of that and see that we're being manipulated to think of other people in that way.
That's an excellent point, that disgust is such a strong emotion that it can be sort of weaponized even sometimes.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way of putting it. Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it, that it can be weaponized against us sometimes. And so we just have to be aware of that and not allow it to happen.
So talking about emotions, why do you think the gross, morbid, and creepy bring us joy and happiness?
Well, I think that personally, I take a lot of delight in how crazy our our world, our universe, and nature are. I mean, I think there's a lot of joy to be had if we are willing to look at the world around us with new eyes and not be scared or embarrassed about all of the weird and gross things that go on. I mean, nature is certainly not embarrassed to find all kinds of clever solutions to problems. You know, throughout animal evolution, you just see so many creative solutions to problems. You know, I just think about how delightful it is that something like, what was the animal that makes the square poop? Was it wombats? Yes, I should have had that example ready, but, you know, I find it really delightful that an animal like a wombat can make square poop and thinking about how does it do that? Why does it do that? You know, and there's just so many interesting things happening all around us in nature. So I always like to say, I love to turn over a log and see what will slither out, because there are just so many, you know, hidden wonders, I think, around in the world all around us. We're often just a little too afraid to, you know, to take a look.
But it also applies not just to the natural world, but to actual human nature. Like looking at all of these museums of oddities, for example, or yes, pictures from the 18th, 19th century, I mean, I love looking through them, and they are not pleasant.
That's right. I mean, I think it's really a pretty modern phenomena how squeamish we are about a lot of things. I mean, when you look at even death, people talked much more openly about death and things that now we would think are really very morbid. You know, even in the 1800s, like you were saying, people would make, you know, elaborate pictures out of the hair of loved ones who had died. And I've seen in museums, you know, these really beautiful pieces of artwork that were made with a dead person's hair. And now that seems kind of strange. I can't imagine anyone who I know now, you know, taking locks of their loved one's hair after death and making art out of it or things like that. But, you know, I think that these museums of oddities are filled with these things for a reason, because we are actually fascinated by them. and have always been, I think it's really a pretty modern phenomena that we're so squeamish about so many things.
Okay, so where do you think the line between joyfully creepy and horrifying and scary lies?
I think that's a great question. And I think it's kind of a moving line. I think it's a little bit different for everyone. I think for some people, for example, you know, they get the most freaked out by any kind of insects and creepy crawlies. For other people, you know, they just absolutely cannot stand to watch any kind of scary movie where it involves death or killing. While other people love horror movies, you know, I think it's kind of a moving target for sure. I personally find a lot of joy in creepy things and even for some things that are a little scary, as long as they don't feel like a direct threat. You know, there's a psychologist named Paul Rosen who uses the term benign masochism. And that is the feeling of pleasure that we can get from pushing ourselves and witnessing something scary or creepy or gross. So for example, a lot of people will line up to smell a really disgusting flower called the corpse flower that smells like something dead and rotten. People want to smell it. You know, why would they do that? Well, it's this little form of benign masochism where your brain knows that you're safe, you're not going to get sick from smelling this, but your body doesn't know that. And so you get this tension and kind of a thrill of challenging your body while knowing actually that you're safe. It's a little bit like riding a roller coaster, he compares it to, of, you know, there's that thrill of knowing that you're going to survive riding the roller coaster, but your body doesn't know it. Your body feels like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to die. So it challenges you in that sense of like facing death while also knowing in the back of your mind that you're actually safe. So I think we all have our different lines for when it goes too far. You know, for some people, things like clowns are extremely creepy. And that's one thing that I wrote about in the book. I'm actually kind of curious whether this is an American phenomenon or is this universal? Do people in Europe have the same feeling that clowns are really scary and creepy sometimes?
Not so much. Like, I haven't actually seen many clowns even when I was young. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a bit bizarre that people are a bit afraid, at least to me.
Yeah, here in the U.S., we have, you know, all kinds of things about creepy clowns, movies, and, you know, clowns have become this very scary thing. Whereas, you know, back in the 1950s, clowns were very popular children's entertainment. There were TV shows like Bozo the Clown, and, you know, the clowns were happy and friendly and something that kids loved. And now I'd say there are more people in the U.S. who are afraid of clowns than who would want to have a clown at their child's birthday party. So it is a lot of, you know, it's definitely part of that cultural background of what you think is gross or not gross or scary or not scary. In the case of creepy clowns, I think, you know, clowns feel creepy to a lot of people because what psychologists say is that there's this contradiction between the clown that has this big painted on grin and yet you don't know what it's going to do. It, you know, they act in very unpredictable, strange ways. They don't, you know, behave according to normal social behavior. They act very goofy and strange. And so there's that disconnect where you don't know for sure whether something is a threat, and that's what gives you the creepy feeling. So, you know, again, what we think is creepy can vary from person to person based on, you know, what your experiences have been with this. Does it seem like a threat? Does it seem like a safe threat? Or does it seem like a real threat?
Interesting. And taking clowns, so they usually have these exaggerated features, don't they? And they can be a bit threatening rather than sort of benign.
Okay. So I remember when I was a kid, for example, that I read a book by Stephen King called It, and it was about this scary clown that lived in the sewers and that would catch kids and eat them or kill them. And that really changed my perception of clowns. I don't think I had an opinion one way or the other about clowns before that. So it just goes to show that, you know, what we're exposed to culturally can affect what we think is creepy or what we think is disgusting. And I think that, you know, that probably holds true for a lot of other things besides clowns as well.
So going back to what you described in the beginning, the way that all of this dental equipment was dumped on your driveway. So right. Do you think we can use this sort of gross and weird stuff as a gateway to really get people interested in science, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that if someone's a teacher, for example, they will find that if they teach a section using CSI, forensic science, all of a sudden kids will be way more interested in chemistry and all kinds of science that they maybe didn't think they were interested in before. But it's really about how it's applied. And I think that we can use, and we should use, the fact that we're interested in creepy, gross, and strange things. There's nothing particularly wrong with being interested in, you know, bugs and our bodies and bodily fluids and things like that. It's not necessarily something that we need to be so embarrassed about. And so I think absolutely we should be getting people more interested in science using those subjects. I mean, I think if you asked a lot of people, are you interested in reading a science book? They would say, no, not necessarily. But I tend to find that when I say, oh, I've written a book about gross, creepy, and weird science, and I write all about things like, you know, insects and eating them, and I write about things like, you know, whether our dogs would eat us when we died, or the mystery of why disembodied feet have been washing ashore in British Columbia, people say, ooh, what's that about? All of a sudden, they're very interested. And it really does get them interested in science. That if I had just said, you know, it's about
come
chemistry
for the gross,
and
stay for the science.
If I just said it was about entomology and chemistry and, you know, bacteriology, I think their eyes would glaze over. But it's very different to study, you know, to learn about bacteriology versus learning about the bugs that will, you know, decompose us when we die. So I think we should absolutely capitalize on people's curiosity wherever that curiosity lies.
Excellent. Well, Erica, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us what are you currently working on?
Sure. Well, right now I'm working very hard on a big package of stories that will be coming out celebrating the last century of science for Science News Magazine, which is celebrating its 100th year, making it one of the longest running science magazines in the world. So I'm very proud and excited to be working on stories about the last century of science for them. And I'm still hoping to get back to that story that I was working on for National Geographic before the pandemic, which is actually about one of my favorite topics, which is menstruation and the menstrual cycle and how science and society are changing their views around menstruation. So I look forward to getting back to thinking all about periods in the near future.
Yeah, sounds interesting. Really good, nice project.
Yeah.
So where can our listeners find more about Gory Details, your book?
Sure. They can go to gorydetailsbook.com, which will take them to my website, and they can see all about the book and when it's out and where to buy it and more about me and other things I've written.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.